We're starting a new month. And that means I get to go through the picture and the verse with you. So tonight, we are supposed to go through one of the pictures and the verse itself and just kind of take a look at it. My name's Tuere Salam, one of the guiding teachers here. We are going through the ox herding stories. They're really pictures and a verse. And we are making our way through it. It's a pretty strong Zen practice. But we are not Zen, and we are still doing it because we're just going to do it in our own way. And so, so far, I think it's been pretty good, pretty exciting. You're starting at the right time. We're on the second picture in the whole set of 10. And so, we're still at the very beginning. It's how our practice unfolds, how practice unfolds, how awakening unfolds. And, so I hope you enjoy it. I want to start before I show you the picture and talk about the verse and the picture itself. I thought I would just spend a little time kind of telling you how I see this picture of where we're at. And if you know me, you know I love the Dhamma stories about spirits that come and visit the Buddha late at night. There are all these stories in the canon about the Buddha would be sitting in Anapintaka's monastery in what's called Jetta's Grove. I've never been there, but he would be sitting there, and it would be in the late night hours, so there's no lights on. It's just pitch black. He probably can't see his hand in front of his face. And in the midst of this pitch black night, spirits would come and visit him and ask him about how they too could be liberated. Just like we would go to a teacher and have a practice interview. They have little practice meetings with him. And one such person came to the Buddha, you know, and when he got there, he pretty much lit up the whole grove area with his radiance. And he asked the Buddha, basically, is it possible to come to the end of suffering? That he had tried to go from one end of the earth to the other, and he had just basically just stopped doing everything other than just, you know, the basic necessities. I've just been traveling back and forth across this world. And I just keep dying and starting all over again. Is it possible to get to the end of the earth by traveling? Is what he wanted to know. Could I find a path? Could I find a way to get to the end of the earth? And the Buddha said, no, it's not possible to find the end of the earth or the end of suffering by traveling. But he said, if you do not travel, you will not find the end of the earth. That you needed to find the end of the earth, and that was possible. And so he wanted to know, well, what if you can't find it by traveling, then how do you find it? And the Buddha said, it's in this fathom long body that you can find the end of the earth. It's in the fathom long body that you could find what I think they were both talking about was the end of suffering. We could find it. And that is significant when we start coming into these Zen pictures because they're designed to help us begin to see the ends of the earth. So how I would like to do my months when I'm talking about these pictures is I would like to take the first 2 weeks and talk about the pictures in relation to a full awakening. This movement of our wisdom on the path of awakening. And so how awakening unfolds or how our practice unfolds. And then I'd like to take the second 2 weeks to talk about how this unfolding happens in some moment in time. So the whole stories can be seen as both the full awakening of our understanding, and it can also be the awakening in a moment in time when you begin to understand. And so that's the way I'd like to perceive it. I'm not quite sure how Tim is going to do it. And then I'm hoping that at the end of the month, we'll all share some expression of how this month unfolded for us. So if we think about full awakening, just the possibility to awaken, what the Buddha was telling Rahitasa, that in order to stop suffering, we needed to get to the end of it. And the way to get to the end of it is in this body. What I think the Buddha was saying is one of the main reasons why we can awaken. But it requires that we have a kind of a different perspective on difficulty. Because I think the reason why we can awaken, what Buddha kind of saw that allowed him to awaken, was we can perceive suffering. We can perceive dukkha. That's what he called it, dukkha. It's not that we can perceive problems. So we can perceive something ain't working right. That's not a big deal. That's not the dukkha that the Buddha is pointing to Rahitasa. He's not pointing to, can you tell something's going wrong? You know, can you tell that you don't like cold weather, or, you know, when the electricity goes off, you're having a problem with that? Or just me and my lights, you know, I don't like the way these lights are. I mean, that's not dukkha. That is the nature of existence. What Buddha was pointing to was we can perceive our adding on to life's experience, our creation of dukkha. We can perceive that. Our creation of our own suffering, we can perceive it. And because we can perceive it, we can free ourselves from that we can perceive. So the reason why I'm pointing to this is that we didn't always perceive dukkha. You know, depending on our level of practice, it depends on how sensitive we are to the perception of dukkha. And the greater our practice, the deeper our sort of traveling into the nature of mind, the more sensitive we get and the more we can perceive this added on kind of dukkha. But when we were in last month's picture, kind of searching for the ox, it's really pointing to we're perceiving something, but we don't know what it is that we're perceiving. We just know something is not right. Something's not working. Something's not okay. We can begin to perceive the pattern cyclical nature of something in my life. I seem to be coming around to the same difficulty over and over and over. No matter what I do, I seem to notice that I have these same problems over and over and over. I change my jobs, I change my partners, I change my living, I change, you know, everything. I change everything I'm doing. And still, I have the same difficulty over and over and over. We can begin to perceive the cyclical nature of that. And we can perceive that something else is going on and not really sure how to fix it. So we kind of search around for stuff to fix this. If we could not perceive this, and before we kind of stumbled into the path and we started actually even talking about dukkha, if you were anything like me, you did not know anything was like going wrong. I could tell you if, you know, my life was crappy because I didn't like the way things were going. But I didn't think that there was something that like I'm causing this difficulty. I didn't think that. I thought it was more like I got a crappy life and the life is what's making everything so bad. And I'm, look at me, I'm doing okay because I'm holding it together. So I must be okay. But my life, all the mess that's coming at me, I certainly didn't perceive that as me causing that. My father caused it. My mother caused it. You know, racism caused it. But I didn't have this perception that it had anything to do with me. Other than I either am good enough to handle what the mess that I'm kind of like having to deal with, or I'm not good enough to handle it. So there was a perception of, yeah, I'm not good enough, or, you know, I deserve this, or something like that. But I didn't perceive that I was the cause of my suffering. Not even close. It was not until I started coming into the Dhamma that I could even perceive the possibility that I could be causing my own difficulties here. And this is a completely different way of thinking about looking at life. That perception, that capacity to perceive dukkha is why we can awaken. Because the Buddha was saying that dukkha, the result of it, dukkha being suffering, this perception that I'm adding on to my difficulty. That perception creates, it results in one of two ways, one of two things happening. When we start feeling this kind of added on suffering, we either go deeper into bewilderment or we find a noble search to find our way truly out of it. And for those of us on the path, it doesn't really matter how far along you're on the path. It doesn't even matter if you're like, well, I heard about Seattle Insight. They do meditation. I'm going to give that a try. So tonight you happen to be on the call. It doesn't really matter how long you've been on the path, because everybody on this call has an understanding that something else needs to be done. You're looking for something, and that is what the Buddha called a noble search. You're not just spinning back into the difficulty, I'd say the way we spent the bulk of our life before Dhamma. It was just this kind of dealing with whatever came up. So whatever came up, we just dealt with it and never paid attention to the fact that we deal with things the same way every time. So for me, I yelled a lot. So my kids would say, you know, if I didn't like something, I would yell. I would yell and yell and yell and yell and yell and yell until eventually somebody is sick of my yelling and tighten it up. The boys would do what I want. Somebody would rearrange things. And then now I'm not yelling. So of course I thought it's the yelling that gets my way. So that's what I did all the time. I put pressure on people to get my way, and all that pressure got my way. So there was this kind of capacity to make things work the way I wanted it to work. So I didn't think I was doing something wrong, or, you know, maybe it's not so nice to yell at people. I could kind of figure that out, but, you know, I'm only yelling because I have to. Because that's the only way to get you to do what you need to do so everybody's happy. Meaning pretty much I'm happy. And if I'm happy, everybody's happy. If I'm not happy, nobody's happy. So this kind of process that we're talking about here is this coming into an ability to actually awaken. This is where we're at here at this start of these stories. We are at this precious moment where the truth that we could awaken is actually right here in front of us, because we're stepping out in some noble path, some noble search. And it's precisely because we're stepping out into this noble search that we can awaken. I think that's why the Buddha's the Four Noble Truths, he didn't call them the Four Noble Truths, but they were coined the Four Noble Truths. He just kept saying the liberation of the way to awakening is the recognition that there is the origination, there is suffering, dukkha, there is the origination of that dukkha, there is the cessation of that dukkha, and there is the path that leads to the cessation of that dukkha. That's what he always said. And then that saying turned into the Four Noble Truths. So the first thing that allows for awakening is the knowing of dukkha. And that's where we're at here. There's a quality of knowing, perceiving dukkha, but not knowing how to, not knowing so much how to escape it, but you can perceive it. And so last week we looked at the searching for the bull, and this week, or the ox, and this week we're going to look at another picture here. So I'm going to share my screen. And then we're going to go through this picture for a little bit, go through the verse and kind of talk through I'll just try to point out some things that I think is interesting to note. All right. So can you see that? Yeah. Okay, good. So let's look at this picture. If you remember, you may not remember the last picture. Why don't I just go back? Let me first get the other picture first and kind of start there. That'll probably be better. Let's start here. So how did I do that? Hold on a second. All right, searching. This is what I want to start. All right, so notice this picture here. We went through it last month, but you see that the person is on a search, this yogi on a search, but they're really looking behind them. They haven't quite let go of their old pattern behavior. They're kind of going down the hill because they've been searching all over the place, all the way up the hill, down the hill. But there's a unsteadiness about this, about the search. It's not producing anything, and their basic strength is getting worn out. You know, their energy is waning. But now in this picture, this yogi has seen something, these footprints that lead them to believe that there is the possibility that they're going to find this ox. And these footprints, this moment in time where this yogi is very important in our practice. Because if you can see, their hand is actually like looking. They are interested. They are looking for this ox. They have a perception that there is a possibility of catching an ox, that there actually might even be an ox here because they can see some of the footprints. They're looking forward. So they're actually looking in the direction that leads them to the ox, and they're tied to these footprints. You also can notice they're kind of like on level ground here. So they're not so much, it's almost like they are in the stream of this looking without, I guess I could say it's in their everyday life, the kind of, their everyday life. But where they're seeing the footprints is all over the place, the same places that they've looked before. So this is the wording, the little phrases here. Along the riverbank, under the trees, I discover the footprints. Even under the fragrant grasses, I see his prints. Deep in the remote mountains, they are found. These traces can no more be hidden than one's nose looking heavenward. So I want to take these words and kind of parse them out a little bit. This stage, from my studying about looking into these pictures, this stage is really pointing to when we have a glimpse of Dhamma, we have a connection. These footprints are kind of like pointing to, we have some practice here. It doesn't have to be that we are totally brand new, but there's been enough connection to the Dhamma that we're beginning to see something. We're beginning to believe that there's something to this Dhamma here. There's something to this meditation. I'm not quite sure what it is, but there's something to it. And I want to investigate it more. I want to get to know a little bit more about this. I don't know. I'm not quite sure what it is, but I know there's enough here that I want to begin to look. So some people say that this is the place where you start to want to get a little bit deeper into understanding what the Buddha said. Like you actually go and listen to Dhamma talks rather than just meditation. So usually it's just meditation. You might go do some meditation, but then this meditation begins to take a hold and you're like, I think I'm actually going to take a beginning class and actually come to understand this meditation. What exactly is this meditation? Or you start going more regularly to the Dhamma talks, some of the, like the Monday night talk or the Sunday morning or Thursday, you start actually paying more attention, taking more notes, wanting to find a book that you could read that helps you understand this a little bit more. What exactly is this stuff that's going on here? And you see things in the path that just in your everyday life that might point to something is really happening with this meditation I'm doing. What may have started out as just a way to get you calm. That's when I started meditation. I was overwhelmed and I needed to calm down. And so I just thought, oh, I'll just learn how to meditate so I can calm down. And then when I remember being on the path here, I could begin to see some things were going differently. Some my just things were happening. I mean, I was still reactive. I was still problematic. I still had a lot of difficulties going on, but there was something that I could connect to that I don't know, I'm struggling here because I can't really figure out what exactly kept me so tight to the path. Everything in my life was still pretty much the same, but there was something about the felt sense of reading. I think some of you know that I came into the Dhamma by way of Trungpa Rinpoche's book on the 59 slogans. And so I would read a slogan at night and then I would read his commentary about it. And the book was entitled Training the Mind, Mind Training, Cultivating Loving Kindness. And I could, for not for the life of me, understand how these slogans or these little phrases had anything to do with cultivating loving kindness. They didn't make any sense. Like one slogan would be drive all blames into one, meant you had to take responsibility for everything, including the stuff you didn't even do. That did not seem like cultivating loving kindness to me. Give up all hope of fruit. Give, what was it? I think it was, let go of all hope of fruition. Like I was a Christian. Hope was the fundamental thing of my life. And here this was, let go of all that. And so when I came onto the path, I had these little footprints. Like, why would someone say that? Why would that help you cultivate loving kindness? It didn't make any sense to me, and I didn't have any proof that it would actually cultivate loving kindness. But there was something about it that caught my heart, my sense of connection. I believed it. I believed something was underneath all this. Something was connected to all this. So along the riverbanks, under the trees, I discovered the footprints. In the first picture, this yogi was looking by the river and couldn't find anything. Even under the fragrant grass, I see the prints. I think this is pointing to, well, let me just back up here. I'm going to tell you my perception about these words and the pictures, but take it with a grain of salt because your perception and your understanding of these words and how they read to you are it's more realistic and more important than what I'm saying. I'm just going to give you mine and might help broaden your understanding. And over the course of the month, we broaden our understanding so we can see into these words more deeply, see into the pictures more deeply. But my thoughts are even under the fragrant grasses, I see, it should be their prince, because it's whatever gender you are. So I see their prince. But the fragrant grass is kind of like pointing to, you see the prince even in the midst of all of your life, all of the sensory movements in your life, you can still see there's something underneath. It's sort of like me reading Trungpa Rinpoche's book. I would read this slogan. It didn't make any sense. I would read his commentary. It still didn't make any sense. But I could see, I had a glimpse of something there. Something felt right to me. And that's what I think this is pointing to. So deep in the remote mountains, they are found. And if you remember the first picture, he's coming down, they're coming down that mountain, but they had been up in the mountains. They were searching all these remote mountains and river banks, and they were just looking everywhere for some escape from this perception of dukkha that they're beginning to see and needing an escape for it. And so here, they are seeing glimpses of the possibility of freedom or the possibility of happiness, even in these remote mountains. So deep in remote mountains, they are found. These traces can no more be hidden than one's nose, looking heavenward. In a way, I think what this is pointing to is that the signs are quite obvious, but it's as obvious as, one's nose on their face. But we are always looking outside of ourselves for the answer. It's what Rohita says. That's what his problem was. He was looking, he was going from one coast of the country to the other, just across the globe. He was traveling and trying everything, and it didn't work. He could not get to the end of suffering, but he could perceive that suffering, there was something to this suffering, even though he couldn't see how to get out of it. And part of that, because he was looking outside. So this looking heavenward for some liberation, looking outside ourselves, is part of the problem. And at the same time, we can see the glimpses of the potentiality of Dhamma throughout our lives in the deep, dark, deep, remote places in our lives. In the riverbanks, and even in the fragrant grasses. It doesn't matter. They're everywhere. And yet we can't see the ox. We can't see how it works. We don't really know anything at this point. We just see these footprints. We don't even know if the prints belong to the ox that we're looking for. So there's a caution that also comes, not a caution, I guess. I'm calling it a caution, but it's a necessary thing that has to happen. That's part of this, I think it's part of this stage in our practice. Is there's a tendency to build and create an imaginary ox. What we think this ox actually is going to be. We can't see it. We haven't seen it. So we begin to build in our own limited understanding what we think this ox is going to look like. What we think the ox is going to be. And we begin to kind of like form our own opinion about what Dhamma is and what liberation is and what emptiness is. We hear about emptiness or non-self, and so we start forming all kinds of opinions about what we think it is, what we think it's going to be. All of this is pointing to what we are going to fight with later on. So in this picture, we are both seeing the truth, but we don't know what it is that we're seeing. So we begin to make up the mind, the ordinary mind begins to make up some understanding about what Dhamma is. It begins to craft some kind of belief about what emptiness is. So, you know, some teacher will talk about emptiness, or some teacher will talk about liberation or happiness or whatever we talk about. It's sort of like me reading Trungpa Rinpoche's book and not really understanding anything I was reading. So I just made stuff up in my mind about what I thought I was supposed to be doing, what I thought I was supposed to be finding, what I thought Dhamma was, how I thought I was supposed to be. And later, as we get further in, we are going to have to fight with these thoughts about what we're creating in our minds right now. And actually, that tug, that battle between our opinion of what we think the ox actually is and the truth of what the ox is what gives us the possibility of freedom here later on. But right now, we're pretty much tied to these footprints. We haven't seen anything, so we're kind of tied to the footprints, and the footprints themselves are showing up in just our basic life, however our life is moving through. Let me see if there's anything else I want to cover. I do want to say this, this place here can also generate a kind of, it's a weird dichotomy here, because we have a glimpse. So it was like me and Trungpa. I would just remember the book reading some of the slogans and not really believing what it is that the Trungpa Rinpoche was saying. I'm going to turn this the screen off, since I've already covered. I don't think I'm going to look at this anymore. So Trungpa would have these, he would say these commentaries about these slogans. And I, as a teacher, I can give a Dhamma talk about some subject in the Dhamma. And you may hear me and you say, I don't know about that. Like Rahitasa, right? Some spirit being. You're like, she just says it like that is true, that he's a spirit being and he just showed up with the Buddha. I don't know if I believe all that. And there's a lot of that in this picture. There's a lot of non-belief and non-trust. And it's a kind of a weird dichotomy, because we both are tied to the footprints, the glimpses that we've had, and we're tied to that. So we're earnestly looking into this Dhamma. And at the same time, we don't have any proof that it exists. So this vacillating between believing and not believing, trusting and not trusting, is very much a real part of this this stage in our practice. This lack of trustworthiness. And I'm going to talk about this more in the second half, but this lack of trust even shows up when we've gone deeper into the practice, but we come up on having to use our practice in a different way. That lack of trust shows up again. It shows up every time we're not quite sure where we're going. We can have a really strong practice, and we've had that practice for, I don't know, 10 years. And then we hit this plateau. And it doesn't seem to be, it's like a dull. Where am I going? What is all this? And all of a sudden, we're back in this picture here, trying to figure out. We have glimpses of the possibility that there's something deeper, but we don't really see it. And we're not really sure. So this natural doubt arises. And I think the Buddha was poignant that the reason or the importance of the Dhamma is that we investigate it for ourselves, that it is to be investigated by the wise. It is that come see for yourself. That's the whole point of it, that there's no way that you can just be told what the Dhamma is. Trump never could have told me what the Dhamma was. He could tell me these slogans and I could read his commentary on it. But the true finding of it is each one of us has to find it for ourselves. And there's something about this need for the footsteps or the need for the glimpses and the connections that we make that keep us interested enough in the Dhamma to go and look, to continue this search and to continue looking for this ox. Throughout our entire life, there's something important about that. That's what I think is the most important, that this sense of skeptical doubt that's very important in Dhamma. It's a hindrance, but it is a necessary hindrance. And next month, we're going to talk about skeptical doubt as a hindrance and how that skeptical doubt in any given moment supports our liberation. But right now, it was the Buddha's whole process of the Dhamma was based on the notion that the Dhamma was timeless. It was easily accessible and that it was to be investigated by the wise. So the point of this stage in our practice is that when you feel that sense of, this is interesting. I don't know if I believe this, but there's something here. That felt sense experience is what keeps you on the path. It's what brings you into awakening. And so this period in practice is so important for our ultimate development. It's because faith in Dhamma, faith in this practice is not based on just accepting what someone says. Faith in this practice is cultivated by the actual following those footsteps, following those glimpses, and coming into your own understanding where it's verified by you. So you may follow my faith in the beginning, like I followed Rodney's faith in the beginning because I wasn't quite sure. Or in some respects, I followed Trungpa Rinpoche's faith because I wasn't really sure he knew what he was talking about. I was reading it. I liked it. There's something there, but I'm not really sure. But as I continue to search for those footsteps, that felt sense experience it became real and verified for me. And then over time, it became abiding, and I just abide in it. I'm not as searching, but I still have times where I'm back in the searching mode because something has come up and I've never faced it with the Dhamma. Now I have to face this kind of searching again. So anyway, I think that's all I wanted to kind of point out with this. Let's see. One of the commentaries here says that in this stage, a yogi has not yet started the path. They've not started to practice. This would be the stage of thinking you want to actually practice with this Dhamma, but you haven't actually started. I can accept that, but I also think this stage shows up, where you've started the practice, but it's not as deep. It's just me reading the commentaries and reading the slogans, reading the commentaries, and I'm not really sure what it is. So I haven't started investing a lot in my life around it, not really going on retreats, not really doing much to invest in this. But I do have a sense that this is something that's important. So I think let's just sit for a moment and then we'll take some questions and see if you have any, or if you want to share anything. I can put the picture back up. Okay. So let's see if anybody has any comments you want to share, or questions, or anything. Can you see yourself in this picture? Can you see your practice, places that you've been where you've been a little hesitant in practice? Yeah, Sean or Bruce. Go ahead.
Okay. I really see myself in this picture in the very beginning of learning that there was such a thing as the Dharma. And I just feel an incredible appreciation that I saw the footprints, and for the first time that I saw them, and which led me to my first day long, my first Dharma talk, my first very simple instructions of how to do the practice. And I applied them after I left that day, and it worked at that particular time for what I was dealing with. It worked and still works. And even now when I'm lost, because I still get lost, the footprints are still there. And then I find the footprints and it's like I start again from a new place.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. That's it. It's the little glimpses that act. You see what you don't even see the fruition yet, but the footprints are what keeps us engaged in the practice. If we didn't have those footprints, we would just give up the search completely. But it's something about these little glimpses of liberation and possibility that keeps us connected to the practice. And we actually begin to search and find a way for ourselves to trust it.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kathy, what about you? I guess I have to hit ask to unmute. Oh, you got to unmute again. I had to ask you again.
Okay. Thanks. I'm really intrigued by looking at the picture and then taking in your words toward the end of your talk to do with recognizing the beginnings of a practice. I mean, you know, you see the footprints, and I realize it's not some teacher telling me it, but I've got to see them I got to feel this for myself. I think that's where you were headed with that, that I have to trust looking at these footprints. It's just my self and my perceptions and is that where you were going with that?
No, the footprints are, it's not you. So don't try to understand the picture, right? Don't try to, this is what we do. We try to understand it. We can't see it. So we're trying to declare it to be something. But the point of the footprints is I've seen it with you. Little moments when we're having Dhamma talks, and then you'll be like, oh, I got it. Oh, I understand something. I don't even know if I believe it or understand it. But there are these little moments when we feel something clicking. We believe something is clicking, and we're not even sure what it is or if it means I understand. It doesn't matter. It's those little glimpses into the reality of Dhamma that helps us stay connected to it and keep trying. Even though in reality, a lot of our life is exactly the same. And yet there's a difference. There's something different and there's something that's the same. And so there's a way in which we're beginning to learn the escape from this added dukkha that we put on our lives. And it's something we can perceive and see, and yet we don't necessarily understand it or know it. So that's what it is. The footprints are those little kind of glimmers of possibility that you might actually be able to awaken. There might be something here to this. And you're not quite sure what you're going to do yet. So this would be probably before you started all your practice, right there at the beginning, like at your beginning class. This is more of where it's at. Or if you're at a moment when you have some difficulty, this is right before you start applying the Dhamma to it. You believe the Dhamma can work here, but you're not quite sure how.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, I do have a lot of that. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Deborah. I think I have to ask you to unmute.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
One of the things that impressed me looking again and again at this picture is the amount of sunlight in the picture. It seems just drenched in light. And so is the light out in the world or inside the seeker?
I don't know, but it's pretty great that you're seeing that. That's what I'm trying to say. It is much lighter than the first picture. So,
Yeah, he's out in the open place.
Yeah.
Place.
I can see that.
It made me think of, I think the place where I started my path, whatever path I'm on, was actually camping in Hawaii after a yoga retreat, reading Buddhist psychology. And that was just something opened up, like sunshine came in. And this picture brought me right back to that place. Thank you.
There, that's it. Beautiful. Before you go, I go to you, Amber. Tiara sent in a question and asked, How do you stop hoping for fruition and yet keep searching? Therein lies the footprint. I think what that slogan is pointing to is that if we put all our faith in the hope of fruition, hope of something happening, a certain result, a hope of getting this, that we are putting our sort of, we're adding on dukkha, because this is part of the reason we have so much struggle, is because we create these expectations that we have a certain result. And then if we don't get that result, then it somehow feels like we were lost or let down or something's wrong. It shouldn't be that way. And instead, what the letting go of all hope of fruition is, the idea that the truth or genuine freedom lies in being with whatever is in the moment, and not in the hope that it's something else, or that it works out the way you want it. That your actual liberation is what Buddha was pointing to with Rohitasa, is in this fathom long body. It's right here in the present moment. It's not in the future getting what you want. And that's what I think that slogan is pointing to. So if you let go of our hopes, end result be in a certain way, and instead you don't have to let go of hope altogether, but you let go of the end result be in a particular way, and you if you have hope, it's like, well, I hope it works out like this, but you know, I'm prepared and I have the capacity to handle whatever comes. That is different than the way I lived my life at that time. It was, please God, you gotta let me get this job. I have to have this. It has to be this way, or I'm not going to be able to make it. So please, please, please God, you have to do this. And that kind of wanting a certain outcome is what you're letting go of. And instead, you could have some wish for it to end up a certain way, but there's a faith or a trust that you cultivate that, yes, I can handle whatever comes. Amber? Yeah, you're welcome. Oh, I think I have to ask you to unmute. I keep forgetting.
Hi there. Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Oh, great. Your talk at the beginning really inspired me. It was the best thing I've heard in weeks, just that idea of in any moment, and it's both the long game, but it's also in this exact moment that this could strike us, that something could happen where we could awaken. Yep. And drawing our attention to that feels so good, feels so inspiring. And I think you answered my question with this last one, but it's really like I could really feel in myself that adding on of suffering, where, and the distinction between just the tough parts of life that are just the basic human experience.
Yep.
It is the adding on of something on top of it that makes it the true suffering, that is the dukkha. And so that helped me to distinguish those. And then maybe you already answered this, but so then our mission, so to speak, or what we can do with that is be with what is, pose, huh? To be able to see as clearly what it is, not the fantasy or the wish or the hope or the expectation to be a grandiose thing, but to get closer and closer to reality as it is.
That's right. Okay. That's right. And that's, it's sort of like you can look at this situation in Ukraine.
The
Ukraine situation itself is painful. I didn't make that happen. Putin did that. I'm not blowing up bombs. I'm not doing any of this. And yet I feel this intense misery and sadness about the whole thing. And I don't want it to be. The habit mind of wishing it were not so.
Yes.
That's what we added on. wishing it were not so. And the difficulty is I can tell myself, okay, I'm not going to wish it was not so. I'm just going to accept it as it is. But that is not so easy to do. No, so we still add on this pressure that says, I wish it's wrong. It shouldn't be this way. We still add that on. But the glimpse we're seeing here is sort of like what you're saying, or even as Deborah was pointing out with the brightness, it's sort of like there's a part of us that says, I really think that there's something to this. If I didn't add on, I don't know how not to add on, but I can see where if I just could roll with life as it is, I could liberate my mind. And the whole path is in trying to help us figure out how to do that. But this is the glimpse that says I can begin to see that there's a way to be with the hardship of life and not add on to it.
Ah, that's just profound. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Lori, hi.
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 First off, I'm so glad you're back. I miss you.
That's right. I know I miss you guys too.
I really resonated with a lot of what you were saying tonight. And I'm curious, maybe this is a little bit of the opposite of what Amber was saying and you were talking about, but that slice of doubt, that ability to believe that maybe it can be so, right? Is that part of Dhamma? Like, can you explain a little bit more?
Yeah, it is a necessary part of Dhamma. It is, if it were possible to awaken by simply believing what someone says, I tell you, you know, like the Buddha is an awakened being. And if he could just tell you, this is what it is to awaken, and you believe him, and you could awaken, then great. We'd all be awakened right now. Because we all kind of believe Buddha was awakened, but that doesn't do nothing for us being awakened. And so there's this thing where you actually have to believe in that possibility for yourself. And in order to believe it for yourself, you actually have to experience it. You have to have glimpses, moments. You have to have a doubt that gets loosened. You have to let go. You have to actually tug with doubt and see the freedom that comes with it. And without that investigating for yourself, then you could not awaken, because you would just be trying to follow Buddha's awakening, and it's not possible. So what makes awakening possible is that there's a level of doubt that you then investigate against. And when you investigate against it, then you try the Dhamma out for yourself and you see it. In your own life, you see the verification of your own life. It doesn't really matter what anybody says. Somebody could come in and say, that's it. We are going to be a Christian society and we are not doing any more Dhamma. So you just cut it out. And anybody that does any Dhamma, that's it. We're done with you. We would all still do it. It didn't have anything to do with what anyone says. We wouldn't be able to not do it. We may not tell nobody about it, so we got to stay safe, but we would still practice the Dhamma for the rest of our days, because it doesn't come from my belief in something that someone said. It comes from a direct experience of the possibility of freedom, and that possibility is what keeps us connected. So we need the doubt. And that's a lot of what's here in this picture. There's a lot of doubt in the truth of what this is, because you don't really see it. You only see glimpses of footprints. But that the glimpses and the doubt together keeps you in the search for this, to see if it's true. The glimpses keep you inspired and motivated, and the doubt comes from the reality that you haven't really seen it. And so you're kind of stuck in this place. But it's important, because when you investigate doubt for yourself and see the truth of it, that is what solidifies your faith in the path. And as you get further along, your path gets stronger and stronger, not because someone tells you, but because you know for yourself. You've investigated it for yourself. Well, this was a great night. I hope I've inspired you to head into this month. We're going straight in to see what's going on. I'm totally inspired. And so next week, we'll do just a little bit of a recap, and then we'll go into small groups and kind of talk about it. So, you know, just contemplate here. You have the pictures. We actually set up a page. Well, we didn't. Cheryl did. Cheryl set up a page that is on the website where you can look at that theme. You can look at the picture for this month. Don't look ahead. Don't worry about those pictures. We're going to get to them. Just look at the picture for this month and look at the verse. And I would propose that you just do it. Just look at it once a day, in the morning, at night, over lunch. Just take a look at it once a day. Just kind of give yourself 5 or 10 minutes to just look at the picture, read the verses, and let it speak to you in its own way. And then next week we'll come back and talk about some of the things we're seeing and how we're feeling and what were maybe even some of our old time, you know, when we felt like we were in this, seeing the glimpses and not really seeing the ox itself. That's what I think. So, how does that sound? Sound like a plan? Good. All right, then. So, thank you so much for your kind attention. And next week, we'll see you at 7 online. We're going to be online this whole month. And we will begin again and see what we can find out about this this footprint kind of picture. All right?
Okay.
Thank you so much.